Welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. New podcast sponsor, Velo Sports. Take your game and your bat speed to the next level with Velo Sports. With over 10 years of experience in speed training, Velo Sports has released the easiest and fastest way to help all players increase bat speed. Velo Sports is used by MLB organizations and collegiate teams who know that bat speed is a true game changer. Check out Velo's innovative bat speed training system and removable puck knob tech today at www.velosports.com. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. This week on the ABCA podcast is New York Yankees minor league rehab coordinator John Kramer. Kramer's been with the Yankees in some capacity since 1999. Kramer was drafted three times and eventually signed out of the University of Evansville with the Yankees in 1999. Kramer spent five seasons pitching in the Yankees organization and eventually moved on to scouting and the front office. In 2016, Kramer took over as Director of Performance Science and onto his current role of Minor League Rehab Coordinator. This is a great episode on professional baseball and keeping players healthy. Let's welcome John Kramer to the podcast. All right, here with John Kramer. We were teammates at Evansville a long time ago, but played in the Yankees organization, but it's been with the Yankees since 1999 in some capacity here and there. This has probably been like 4 years in the works. We've kind of talked about you coming on at some point. So, John, thanks for jumping on with me.
Absolutely, Ryan. Always good to see you and talk to you, man.
Yep. And you have a great story, and that's what I text you. I'm like, you have a great story to tell just because you've done so many different things in the Yankees organization with different jobs, and I think you've done a great job of evolving with things. And so are there any jobs right now that you haven't done for the Yankees?
We have so many jobs and so many people. It's grown exponentially since I first started. But joking aside, I've been fortunate to work for a great organization, some great people that have put me in a position to understand a variety of capacities, operations within the organization. So, I mean, I guess I'll kick that off, but I started, as you mentioned, as a player, not a very good playing career, which most of those that don't end up well end up in the office or coaching somewhere, right? And I'm one of those casualties. So I started after I finished playing with the Yankees in the minor leagues. I started off just as a, Mark Newman at the time gave me the job of, hey, we're just going to see what you can do. Let's give us a year kind of probationary period, as he called it, and see what happens. And fortunately, Damon Oppenheimer got the scouting director job at the time, and he and I kind of had a good rapport, and he asked me to be his assistant. And so I started off, I think that was like 2004 with him, and the scouting department did that for quite a few years to start my career with the Yankees.
What's been the most challenging job for you? Was it director of performance science? Because that really wasn't your background.
Yeah, to hit that up. So started out in amateur scouting and then evolved into, kind of a hybrid player development role where, my job was to try to help integrate the analytics with the player development folks. And You know, I think that was okay. I think I was probably not great at that at the time. It was a transitionary period for many organizations. It was a number of years ago as teams were evolving that space. And so it was challenging. And then, you know, at that time, Brian Cashman had reshuffled some operations within the Yankees and put me in the performance science, director of performance science, which was a challenging role in that it was new. I mean, at that point in time, we probably were the first to have a performance science department. I mean, you know, people had always looked at data and how data can help drive decisions. You know, biomechanics had been around for years, but practically how to integrate that with an organization like the Yankees, I don't know that had been done at the time. And then so here's a person whose background is not in biomechanics, not in the, you know, kinesiology or that space, which I was, you know, fortunate really that Brian gave me the chance to start this department. And I think my first introduction to the staff, I told them, I said, look, if I'm any good at this job, I'm not going to be doing it in 3 years. And that's kind of exactly what happened. I mean, for one reason or another, but we were, given the go ahead by Hal and by Brian to hire some folks. And we brought in David Whiteside, who you've had on as a guest, and he's taken us to a whole nother level. So I think like my skill set at that time, I was good at understanding the architecture and maybe what the layout should look like. And then, you know, luck into the right people. And you set that foundation and you let the people that are really good at it take over. And I think that's where, you know, the Yankees are at today.
I mean, how are you able to adjust on the fly? I think that's a good tip for anybody. You got to be able to adjust on the fly as you go.
Yeah, there's no question. So, one thing I was fortunate when I started that there weren't all the positions that there are now. So now you almost have a specialist and an expert and somebody that really understands a different area. We were smaller staff at the time. And so I think, you know, what I looked at, you know, I guess evolving on the fly, or like kind of looking at where the white spaces were, you know, where could I bridge the gap way back when with the scouting department, it was kind of on the tech side where we didn't have a great infrastructure with respect to how we handled scouting reports, how we amalgamated information, you know, for decision-making. And so I kind of looked at that as my niche. So that was my sort of adaptation on the fly there. And then it evolved into, okay, you know, we brought in Michael Fishman and just a really robust staff, Brian Nicosia to handle our, back guys that really knew what they were doing, you know, not guys like me that are, you know, kind of giving this a go to try to make it a little bit better, but didn't really know what we were doing. And so that was, you know, once that had been built out, where's the next space? And at that point in time, it was probably, you know, understanding like integrating biomechanics. And so we, you know, maybe what we had, I remember, man, this is years ago, and I kind of got laughed at the time, but we had a group, ASMI and Dr. Fleissig, come in and do a bunch of biomechanical evaluations. And, you know, they were doing, it was kind of a study that they were undertaking, so it was low cost to us, low risk. But the risk was the perception. At that time, you know, we had a bunch of kids coming out on the field getting marked up, which, you know, I mean, you're half naked, well, you're more than half naked out there. And, you know, it's at the time maybe seen as a little bit of a mockery. But, you know, in retrospect, I think that's where kind of things were going. And so, you know, and maybe it was, you know, areas like that that, you know, Brian saw were trying to push the envelope, and then that sort of led into the performance science realm. And, you know, again, I was fortunate that I probably saw where things were going, had enough to get us moving in that direction, but not quite the chops to pull it off to really excel. And that's where we've, you know, added staff and folks to really push the Yankees forward in those areas. Yeah.
Well, you and I had talks probably 20 years ago when I was still at Iowa about redoing minor league baseball to where it's aligned maybe a little bit more college from a nutrition, sleep.
Yep.
And I had that conversation 20 years ago. From a player development standpoint, it made more sense to me. It's like, okay, you've got an opportunity, but you're also dealing in your space with 16-year-old kids and 40 or 50-year-old veterans now, you know, where it's much harder, I think, for pro orgs. I think they're getting better, but I think it's a lot harder because you have a much wider range of age groups of players that you're dealing with.
It's partly true, right? So you definitely have to deal with, you know, you handle a guy who's developed his own routine and has a 10-year career much differently than a guy that's looking to develop his routine, you know, that you just first get into the organization, which is much what it's about. But to that point, I think, you know, it's like, so professional coaches were always very good. You know, a lot of respect for old coaches, but a lot of those coaches never coached in college and they never really saw that environment. The only environment they knew was, hey, we play baseball games, you know, and to a degree, the game is a very good teacher, right? And in baseball, you play every day. So it's not like basketball where you have to practice and then you have your game, or football, you practice and then your game. Baseball, you get to basically practice and play every day, which is really nice for development. So, you know, you kind of beg the question from the other side, though. It's like, man, is it too much at times? And are we not allowing players, you know, the resources or the specialization if a kid needs to add 20 pounds or he needs to add some explosive power, right? I mean, I just don't know that we were, you know, to fault of no one, but the perspective at that time was, this is kind of the way we do it. We think this is the best. And I think now you see a lot more college coaches in professional baseball, a lot of people with a wide variety of backgrounds. And then guys like, you know, you and I who had these conversations, you know, our director of player development, Kevin Reese, is, you know, he's maybe a year older than me or a couple years older. And we had those conversations too, you know. So it's kind of like now you're getting people in these roles that are sort of thought outside the box as a player, and they're able to institute these type of programs. And I hear exactly hit the nail on the head that player development is holistic. Some guys need nutrition, some guys need mechanics, right? And if you're always approaching it from one side of things, you never, you know, understand these multitude of perspectives. And now teams have these different departments that add to the conversation about development.
You know, you kind of started assistant pro scouting director a little bit with that on the pro side. Do we see that as much anymore? Just from a technology standpoint, you probably get pretty easy access to be able to bang out the pro side of that, correct? Where you maybe don't have as much hands-on at the stadium anymore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so technically, you know, I wasn't the director of pro scouting. I was more of in player development, but had conversations, you know, along those lines. It was more of integrating some numbers and how we use data with player development. I don't know, the nebulous title was player personnel director, I think, but it had something to do with that. At any rate, you know, so our pro scouting, you know, that is a challenge, right? So you have all this information coming from one end, and the scouts have access to it, and it's how do you decide? You don't want the scout reading too much, but part of it's getting the scout's own opinion, right, and separate from the data, which teams are trying to do. So yes, the answer to that question is all teams have tons of data coming in, TrackMan, Hawkeye, I mean, all the stuff that's involved right now in the pro side. And so, you know, I don't deal with that currently, but I can tell you that our pro scouting director is very tied in with the analytics folks, and it's really important for those guys to have conversations about, you know, I mean, we're obviously going to use the data, but at what point do you apply more to the data? At what point do you apply more to the scout? How do you integrate the two? I mean, that's the kind of the special sauce, I think, that, you know, the good teams do well that leads to good decisions. But there's certainly not a lack of information out there.
Do you think Hawkeye has probably been the biggest impact recently on evaluation?
I mean, that's a good question. Probably a good question that I can't answer necessarily, because I don't use that personally for decision making. You know, that'd be more along the lines of what a pro scouting director. I know it's used. I know we have the folks that can interpret that data. I know that there's also, you know, it's like, it's hard, right? There, Hawkeye's capturing biomechanical data in game from cameras, which is, you know, that's a big leap from, you know, the gold standard of collecting it, you know, in a lab with the dots and with the Vicon cameras, et cetera. So, I mean, I think you have to close the gap as to how good is that information. Maybe it's good. Maybe it is. I don't know. And then once you get it and you realize that it's good, then, you know, what do you, cause you know, basically they're recording, you know, one data point, you know, 500 data points in a second or something, right? I mean, it's an incredible amount of data just in XYZ coordinates. And so you really, it's important how you take that information and then what you decide to create as your output variables. You know, so there's different models that all kinds of people are coming up with. And, you know, again, like, I mean, I kind of understand it in a big picture sense, but as far as what we're doing, we have some really masterminds that are digging into that. So I can't say that it's the most impactful, but I guarantee you that type of computer vision, accessing that sort of information, if it's reliable in games, is what all teams are striving to interpret. Yep.
Who's had a bigger impact on the Yankees, you or Julie?
You're probably talking about my wife, who happens to also work for the Yankees. I think there's no question that she has, because, I mean, what drives all businesses is revenue, and Julie's position is, you know, sales and trying to create revenue. So, you know, maybe John's a nice guy, but I don't know if John really has any value to us or not. But she's got the more tangible value for sure. Yeah,
definitely a better athlete in college, but
no, for sure.
And you don't. Yeah. The thing about you, you don't talk well about yourself, but you are a good pitcher. You are. You know, I think as all of us that played along the way had our ups and downs, but you never give yourself enough credit for how good you are on the mound.
Appreciate that. I mean, you always look back. I mean, it's like every competitor, you always rue the losses more than celebrate the wins, you know. And I think for myself, I always feel like I could have done better, you know, and especially in college, man, because we had such a close-knit team. And that was the one great thing about Evansville and about, you know, the kind of players that your dad recruited were, you know, same type of guys. You know, we really all were. And, you know, you look back on it, and I think I had the ability to be much better. And, you know, you ask yourself reasons why. And I guess the fun part now is, like, diagnosing the track man and seeing what plays, I probably would go at things a little bit differently, you know, as a player. And I think some players had the natural feel to figure some of that stuff out, perhaps, and maybe others didn't. You know, because I was a guy that threw pretty hard, had a decent breaking ball, but never threw enough strikes. And so, like, I wonder, I think I had a ride fastball. So I just wonder back in time if, like, you're always trying to pitch down in the zone, down in the zone, down in the zone. It's like, man, you know, maybe if I just, you know, let it eat up and drop the hammer, you know, off of that four seamer, I might have been better. Who knows, right? And then the other thing is, if your fastball doesn't play now, we just tell you, and you got a good breaking ball, we just tell you to throw more breaking balls. But back in the day, it's like, dude, you throw 94, use your fastball. It's like, well, maybe it's not that good, you know. So you kind of learn a lot over the years, but I appreciate that, Ryan.
Tunneling piece now, too, that I think the dad has helped with, where you're going to see that you're more of a north-to-south pitcher back then, and probably trying to pitch down with your fastball wasn't great, where if you can pitch up with your fastball and then you let your breaking ball work out of that same tunnel, you probably get a few more swings and misses because the deception piece is going to be there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's one area that we're, you know, everybody's still trying to put their finger on, is, you know, we know deception exists. I believe, I can't speak for other people, but I can say my own belief. I do believe that there is some sort of tunneling effect to the baseball. Now, whether that tunneling is the pitches playing off one another, or the tunneling is creating an expectation in the hitter's mind and the pitch deviates off that, it could be movement, it could be speed, right? But the longer that you have to make the hitter, you force the hitter to be uncertain about what decision they're going to have to make, the better off your pitches are going to be, right? I mean, you can call it whatever word you want, but that's essentially what you're trying to do, is whether I'm keeping the flight path similar between two pitches and forcing his late decision, or I'm creating some sort of movement that's different than what he expects. You're trying to create something that the hitter can't. I mean, like the old school coaches say, you're disrupting timing, you're disrupting rhythm, you're trying to deceive the hitter. I mean, that's what it's all about.
At what point in the minors were you like, this is probably not going to happen for me?
You know, man, like, so my last year, they dropped me down. One of our pitching coaches, great mentor of mine, Greg Pavlik, he's like, man, you got a good arm. He's like, let's try something different here. So the end of before my actual last year, they dropped me down about a three quarter. And I don't know why, but I threw strikes and I had a really good two seamer, and you just, like, I could fill up the zone and had it. So I ended up having a lot of success that year. It was only in like 10 innings, but it was pretty good. Got promoted. And as I come back the next spring, I worked my ass off. I'm like, man, I got something here. Worked my ass off, came back the next year. And so I remember I'd lost some weight. I came back my first outing in Tampa in spring training and chunk out the side. And I was like, shit, man, you know, I got it, right? So I go ask the guy, what's my velo? And he's like, yeah, it's 83. I'm like, 83? What are you talking about? I was throwing like 93 last year from here. And so, you know, come to find out, like, then I started getting tired. I ended up being diagnosed with a thyroid issue. They thought it might have been diabetes and for the weight loss, and I just lost a bunch of strength. So the Yankees, man, they were just been so great to me. They gave me two or three months that summer to rehab, get my strength back, get on some medication. And I did, and I came back. I wasn't quite where I was the year before, but I ended up having a nice year. And at the end of the year, they got promoted, you know, I was promoted up to double A. And I was like, man, I think I might give this a try, right? And then so I was hit, though, with just a tough decision, because Mark Newman had asked me, the Yankees released me that year, and I really was going to plan on playing independent ball. I was married. My wife at the time was working for the Yankees, and Mark Newman had asked me, he said, hey, you know, we think you might be good at this office thing. You want to give it a try? And I'm just like, I don't know. You kind of like, that's another dream too, right? So I guess I took the chicken shit way out or whatever. Sometimes I regret that, though, you know, not like just seeing where it would have gone. So to answer, long-winded answer to your question, like, I feel like I still could have done it, but I was presented with such a good opportunity that I felt like I had to take it. Yeah.
And your rehab coordinator now, is there a way to keep guys from getting injured?
Well, I hope not, because then I still keeps me employed right now. Is there a way to keep guys from? I don't think so.
Because it puts in the envelope of athleticism, well, correct? Like that's what it is, correct? Like they're at the top end, running, throwing. They're at the top end. So anytime you're at your top end, you're going to take that chance of something like that happening.
In my analogy, is like a race car, you know, right? I mean, great race car drivers, they're going to wreck. The best ones stay in the race more often than not and win it, but they're still going to have accidents. There's still risk. And it's because you're trying to push a car to its absolute limits. And, you know, we know that we're doing the same thing with the elbow, with all of the studies and, you know, the shoulder and everything else that goes on. I think teams are rightly focused on how to offset and mitigate that risk. But at the same time, like, if you're not pushing the envelope, like, velocity is a deal. I mean, we can all say that. You see the blogs and guys will, opine from time to time about, well, what happened to the old pitcher, and you take velocity. I mean, at the end of the day, like, velos, it's important. It makes everything better if you throw harder. And so everybody's searching for it. The key is to search for it in a way such that you can, do it efficiently, in an efficient sense in your delivery, that you can maintain command, and that you can maintain shape to make your pitches better. So I don't think that we'll ever see an end to injuries. I think that what we can do, and what we feel like we do well with the Yankees, we got a great program in place, some really great people on the training side. And Ben Buck is one of our pitching coordinators that has kind of overseen the workload under Sam. And he's done a nice job with that. And so, you know, I feel like there's some areas in workload management and collaboration across departments that really set the tone for keeping pitchers as healthy as long as you can. But are we going to eliminate injuries? No, the answer is no to that. We can't prevent them. We can offset them, and maybe in some cases prevent them, but not in all cases.
How much has the protocol changed over the years for getting guys back?
A lot.
What are the biggest differences? Because I think that old Tommy John model, there was a lot of throws, and I mean, you can speak to that or not, because I know you probably have some things you can say or can't say.
Yeah.
But it just seemed to me, when they would send that protocol with players, I'm like, this just doesn't make a lot of sense to me how they're trying to get guys back.
So, I mean, in general, like, I can give you like a general framework description for you know, how you might go about it. And what I think makes sense. You think about, like, it seemed crazy to me that, you know, we would see some of these programs where guys are getting up to like 75 throws at 90 feet. And, you know, like, you just, you know, you can ask yourself, like, why? What do you do? What are you trying? I guess the end goal is, what are you trying to get to? You're trying to get a pitcher back to the point where they can throw a first bullpen at some level of intensity, and then pile workload on top of that in a safe and gradual manner. Okay, so if that's the end goal, to get to them to the point where they're throwing, you know, a side session of, let's say, 15 pitches to start, and then you have, you know, five or six pitches they usually get loose, so we're throwing 20 pitches off the mound at a certain intensity. And then prior to that, they're probably going to throw, it depends on the pitcher, between 30 and 40 throws in a catch play to get loose, to get on the mound. And so that's like, that's your end goal. That's probably at the high end, 70 throws, you know, total. and 20 of those or 15 of those with higher intensity. Maybe they get to five on the flat ground that has some level of intensity to it. And the others are kind of utilized to get loose and build themselves up towards those intense throws. So like, I guess I just ask myself the question, like, why would we be putting a guy at a large, you know, making 75 throws from a distance they never would, which we know is somewhat related to intensity? You're not asking him to do what the goal is, and that's to get him to the mound that you can build in a gradual, safe manner. And that's kind of how we stepwise, you know, our programs is like, let's build the volume first to the point where we think that they're going to need when they get to that higher intent mark. And then once you build the volume, you start to look at the frequency of throwing. If we want them to get to two sides in a week, now we're going to have to, every program starts out 3 days a week. And then you move into accumulating some more frequency with respect to that volume that you've built in a less frequent manner. And then once you get those two factors coupled together, you start to add some intensity on top of the volume and the frequency that you've built. And essentially that's, I think, how the programs evolve for us.
With healthy guys, it seems like that almost a lot of guys don't really shut down a whole lot anymore, do they?
I mean, that's sort of a personal preference, right? We don't know what the right, you talk about some of these throwing programs, you know, in a general sense, like we don't know that that's right either. It makes some sense that we've had some success with the way we've done it, I think. But yes, I mean, personally, I would be more of an advocate to shut down less time and to start, you know, throwing or not stop throwing and just move your arm. You know, right? Just. I mean, it doesn't. I throw a lot as a rehab pitching coach. I mean, sometimes up to 400 throws in a day, maybe even. And my arm's still attached. I haven't had surgery, but I throw, you know, 55 to 62 miles an hour. And so, at some level, right? I mean, even if a pitcher's throwing 20, 25, 30 pitches, 60 miles an hour, 55, you know, hopefully, you know, if they have something to monitor that, or they're good internal monitors, those throws aren't really, you know, they're not reaching a point where they're doing a whole lot to the pitcher, other than, you know, I think maybe there's a neurological component to like, okay, I'm moving this, you know, you're breaking up the tissue a little bit. It's like a nice, almost like they would do a fascial release or something. They're just getting their arm motion and loosening up the muscles a little bit. So I would be more of an advocate of pitchers continuing to throw in the off season, but just be smart about it.
And you've got younger, I mean, your kids are getting older now. Any differences for youth baseball that you would pick?
Geez. You know, boy, that's a big topic. So my son, you know, he played travel ball, 11 and 12, and he couldn't hit. He stunk. So he didn't throw hard, but he threw strikes. He pitched the first game, and he'd sit for the rest of the weekend. He's like, I don't know about baseball, Dad. So he played soccer, and he runs around. He loves to run, so he runs all the time. So now he's just doing soccer. So I've been out of the youth baseball scene, unfortunately, for probably the last 4 or 5 years. You know, when I was in it and what I know of it, you know, it's just really the answer at that level is like tracking the throws to you know, if you had a parent, and they can't, you know, buy catapults or, you know, the Modus sleeve. The Modus sleeve is a great tool, and maybe it's the driveline pulse or whatever it's called now. These workload monitoring devices are great, but they take some labor. You know, somebody's got to set up the app. Somebody's got to sync the throws afterwards, you know? And so I would, if I were giving advice to parents or coaches at the youth level, I would just count your throws. You know, have the kid maybe give you a self-score of intensity or something, or you track the distance, and just track his throws so you know what he's doing. And then the parents, if the kid's playing on multiple teams, then they're responsible for tracking the throws. And then you look back in time and say, you know, I threw 60 throws or 600 throws this week, but I threw 2,000 throws in the next week. Well, that's probably not a good idea, right? I mean, you're getting a major workload spike there. Or I threw 2,000 throws, and the next week I only threw 500. You know, you're getting, you know, kind of these deficits. So when you're in season, you want to make sure that, again, it's a gradual build and you're doing things, you know, appropriate, which is taking into account, I think, the number of throws you make. So that's what I think the youth coaches probably should do. You know, I mean, it'd be easy enough to do for them, but if the coach just had for his team kind of his own counter for what these kids are doing from a throwing standpoint, that would go a long way. You know, just start simple.
And you mentioned David Whiteside, which it's still one of my favorite episodes. For anybody that hasn't listened to that episode with David, go back and listen to it, because he was teaching me things left and right. And how has – I mean, you probably can't speak to it a whole lot, but how has he evolved with you all? Because he's been with you guys for a long time now.
He has. Do you remember the first of the, when he was a kid?
Was right was around it like COVID eight, time.
18. Yeah, I think it was a little bit before little COVID. Bit before. He might have been hired in like 18 or 19, somewhere in there. I mean, David's incredibly sharp, really good. Came from Tennis Australia. He was great when I was the director. He was, obviously working with me, and he ended up doing a lot, of course, a lot of the legwork on the biomechanics stuff. And he's what Dave is really good at. Not only is the nuts and bolts of the biomechanics and the chops you have to, write all the programs, and the formulas, but he's really good with displaying and distilling information, which is a key, I think, component. So that's what he does well. He takes a lot of information and it's like, boom, you got a dashboard, you got a report that you can make some sense out of as a coach. And I think that's where Dave's evolved this, his department. He's up in New York all the time now. So I think, I don't see him as much as I used to, but I know, right? I mean, you see the success of the major league team. You see they kept guys on the field this year, certainly from a starter standpoint, and, Stan having a pretty good year, staying healthy. I mean, I think, that's a credit to the training staff, credit to the manager, credit to the players, and behind the scenes, I think Dave is probably adding to the, those are the major players. And I think Dave's, adding to that as well. Yeah.
Do you go to New York much?
Used to. I don't anymore. Yeah. Yeah. We got, Sam, my boss, Sam Breen, who came from Driveline. I don't know if you had Sam on, but, he's a star. He goes to New York and kind of carries a torch for the pitching department. He's really good. The players up there like him a bunch, So I'm kind of, I mean, travel's fun. It was fun for a portion there in the career. But I got to say that I don't mind Tampa either. So, yeah, I just going to the DR. I haven't been there in a few years, but I don't go to New York a whole lot. I'm going to the World Series, Rhino.
Huh? Happy for you guys.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Happy for you guys. You got two storied franchises going at it, which is,
should be fun.
Is great.
Yeah.
And for y'all, there's so much pressure on you guys to be great every year and not realistic. You're going to get that outside noise from the fan base, which they should. They're one of the most passionate fan bases there are out there. But obviously, you guys know what you're doing behind the scenes. That's all the things of coach or anybody that's in an organization. People from the outside looking in, they don't see all the other stuff that goes into everything that you guys do.
No, they don't. I mean, like you said, geez, the expectation on the Yankees is tremendous, but you have two really good leaders in Hal and Cash that, kind of take the heat and weather the storm for everybody else. And then behind the scenes, what I guess I would want the fans to know is the amount of investment that, Hal and Cash have made in personnel, players. It's not, you can go
taking
out and sign
care
big
of scouts.
Guys. Yeah, man, exactly. We probably
you
have
talk
the largest
to that scouting
staff.
Guys that, and I have friends that weren't with the Yankees that are with the Yankees now, and they are like, they take care of us better than anybody else does.
Oh, yeah. There's an expectation with the Yankees, but there is a certainly a benefit to working for the Yankees organization for everyone. And they've made it a just a great environment, an environment of growth. That's the biggest thing I think that, Cash has done over the years is like, he wants people that are accountable and that want to grow up, and if you're not coming up with new ideas, somebody else is.
Say you get a young player coming to you where you talked about developing routines. Where's and this is for anybody listening in, where would be some of the first places you would start with trying to help a pitcher develop routines as they go?
Pitcher, I think any athlete, right? I mean, the game has changed so much from, when we played, you go out, you got your group stretch, and basically you're talking about what you did but not the night before, and you got a couple half-ass, hamstring, exercises or whatever, do a couple jogs, and you go play baseball. Now there's been the bleeding of the kind of on field with the strength staff and the training room. So the players, really, it's their task to kind of figure out and take from the trainers, the PTs, and the strength staff, what puts me in a good position every day, you know, that loosens me up in a way such that it coordinates with my throwing or my hitting or my running, whatever it may be, and to start my day. And that process sometimes can take upwards of an hour for some of our guys. You know, like now we've got kids in the off season, and you know, it's like 9:30 you can come in, but I know that they're gonna they won't be out there until 10:30, 10:45 to throw because of their pre-routines. You know, so that's one, it, you know, whatever age you're at. And I would say, you know, 80% of it, like you don't want to do something that's going to hurt you. But a lot of the time doing something that you know is fairly simple and not going to hurt you is part of the battle. So I would encourage kids to do something in terms of warm up. I mean, the internet has tremendous resources for developing your routine there. So you have your pre-day routine, if it's a recovery day, or your side day, it might be a little bit different. And then you schedule your throwing. And that's oftentimes, I think, what kids, you know, coaches don't do is they show up for a practice. And you got to put a lot of time into it. And you should put time into what that throwing program looks like. How many throws am I going to make? What's my focus? What's my intent for the day? Those are big things to establish as a young kid. And that transcends all sports. You know, my daughter plays tennis, and that's the same thing we want to do with her. You want to warm up. What's your serve routine look like that makes you feel like you can, you know, create some kick? What's your, you know, routine that gets you in it when your strokes get away from you that kind of gets you back? And so I would say there's the warm-up routine, then there's kind of the pre-throwing routine, which may, you know, include plyos or some other things, and then you get to throwing. But be intentful about what you do is a big deal. And then obviously, you know, nutrition aspects, what recovery, if I had a tough day, I'm going to want to have maybe a little different recovery modality than, you know, an easy day. But taking into account the nutrition and the sleep that goes into that as well. Yeah, that's the routine, you know. And then how do you separate the baseball? You know, there's the baseball person from the person. And I think the mental side, you know, the Yankees are fortunate to have a tremendous mental condition department, but they help the guys with that as well. You know, because if you know, you could be a baseball player, but sometimes aligning your perceived worth with who you are as a baseball player can lead some folks down a tough path, right, mentally. So you have to have that off-field balance. So there's that routine away from the field. What am I going to do to be strong mentally and learn and grow, but also, you know, kick back where I need to regenerate? So
I mean, what are some healthier options you've seen out of guys? What are some healthier options to get away from it, to decompress?
Yeah. I mean, I think the video game stuff's okay, right? I mean, that's just part of the name. I mean, my son's 13, he plays video games. You just got to make sure they're balancing that out. Obviously books, right? If you get a reader, somebody into books, some of the internet stuff, like even getting on Twitter, it can be bad, but it can also be good. There's a lot of good in Twitter and following people that you can learn from and read different things. So I think it's like, you know, setting up maybe an hour of a day where it's like, okay, what's my growth for today? Who do I want to follow, or who do I want to look at, whether it's another athlete or whether it's somebody, you know, interestingly, you know, a lot of these things cross over from profession to profession. So going outside of sports and looking at other professions, right, and, you know, getting a good follow and paying attention to what these folks do as far as their routines go, I think, you know, bleed into the baseball player. So, yeah, I mean, I mean, the kids play golf all the time, right? That's still a deal. You go golf and you go fish. I mean, these things are, that's okay. You know, it's okay to get out there and relax a little bit and compete, you know? So, I think all of that normal stuff is, but the catch is mentally while you're away. But, you know, the other thing, and I think you talked about this a lot, is mindfulness. You know, I was going, you know, I had a tough period. Really, that when I got the performance science job, it was a little overwhelming for me at the time, and I had a little rough patch. And what helped me in the mornings just clear the day was going through the call map, you know. And then you learn, because we all have the voices, right? I mean, you learn how to kick stuff out. I mean, everybody's got that stuff. So I would encourage kids to pay attention to you know, how to, whether it's through mindfulness apps or through a mindfulness training, but how do you kick all the stuff out and really be centered in the moment? That's a skill.
It's a reframing. It's a redirection. I've been doing it for 20 plus years now. So my mind has evolved. I wasn't feeling great before we got on here. So I did a 15 minute. I sat for 15 minutes. Emily Fletcher, I talk about her a lot, but stress less, accomplish more. So I did her 15 minute audio before we jumped on here just to get myself redirected. And I think that's a great way to talk about it is, you're not going to get yourself to stop thinking. Like, you just naturally, that's the brain is supposed to have 30,000 thoughts a day. That's how we evolved to that point. But it's now just redirecting those thoughts to something else, because we all go through it. And 100%. That's why I was going to ask you too, because I think elite performers are wired different in between the ears. I think they're wired much different.
Yeah. You kind of, when you have kids, I think you sort of, you know, you realize it, that whole nature versus nurture model, right? I mean, you know, you can help them and certainly shape them, but I don't know. Yes, there are certain folks, the way that they're built and just innately wired, they have a different, you know, they have a different DNA setup. And some of that may be brought out through the nature that surrounds them or the nurture that surrounds them. But yes, wired different in the way that, like, these kids want, I mean, the big boys, they just relish the moment, you know? I mean, they want to be in the big moments, and other people, everybody gets nervous, everybody has doubts, right? But those guys are able to put that aside in some way and say, you know, kind of like, this is my time. I mean, there's just a different, that's different.
Well, Soto's a great example. Soto probably has some of the best self-talk that we have in the big leagues right now. I think he's a great example of what self-talk and aggressive, positive self-talk can do for you in the performance area.
There's an underlying, like, default level of confidence that I think certain people just carry with them, you know, so you can work on it, and through working hard, skill development, your confidence levels can raise. But there's also just a default level of confidence that certain people seem to have, you know. So if you have a kid that has that, sometimes your inclination is to suppress it maybe a little bit if they get too cocky. And that's the tricky part as a parent, or even as a coach, is like, sometimes you like those kids that you got to, you know, scale them back a little bit. It's hard to build the kids up more. Sometimes it's easier to scale the kids back, but, you know, you sort of want to cultivate that but do it in a way that is positive to the people around them, you know. And that's where, you know, you look at the Yankees and they have leaders that are just tremendous with accountability, but yet, you know, in a positive way of interacting with their teammates. I mean, outside looking, I'm not close to it, but the outside looking in and just briefly being around these guys, sometimes it's pretty special.
Yeah. Are you surprised anybody gets a hit anymore? The way you're around with guys' stuff and they know exactly where to position you, I'm surprised anybody even gets hits anymore.
Well, you know, you saw the recent deal with Class A having his struggles in the postseason. And, you know, I think Hader had struggles in the last round. You know, so some of these elite level closers you're kind of like, how do you even hit these guys? And then they click them in the postseason. I think familiar. I can't speak to it. I've never done it, right? But I think familiarity has something to do with it. I mean, it's like anything, right? It's never the one thing. It's probably a few things. It could be that maybe the pitcher stuff isn't as good if they're at the end of the season and potentially fatigued. Could be that the players, you know, some of the players, it's a long season. You've already kind of locked in your status. Now it's the postseason. I think some of these guys that are special have a heightened level of awareness and a heightened level of focus when they reach these moments. So you get a little bit of fatigue, a little bit of heightened focus, and they've seen the guys more. And they have great game plans. I mean, the Yankees guys are tremendous students of the game, so they're prepared. And all of that might add up to, you know, what you're seeing in terms of success. But, yeah, you don't get to the level that these guys have with the stuff that they see every day without some level of tremendous preparation and belief in yourself. Yeah. Yeah, well, it is surprising.
Judge, Soto, I think all three are good examples. Three completely different setups, swings, like, but are dominating the postseason.
But they work
for the athlete.
That's the other thing, you know. It's like you want to encourage young kids to, you know, I used to work with my son's team and a few younger kids, but, you know, as a parent if your coaches are overly mechanical at a young age, and you know, they have a particular style that they want to fit the kid to, it's a little dangerous. You know, these guys all develop in different ways. Why? Because our bodies are unique. You have infinite degrees of freedom, essentially. And you just want, you know, the more you can create an outcome variable that these kids try to chase and let them self-discover what their moves need to be, you know, that's probably the way you want to develop a young kid. You know, let them be athletic and try to solve problems on their own with a few cues and suggestions along the way.
I mean, do you feel like that's changed probably more than anything, where more focus on external cues than internal cues?
I think so. I mean, probably so. When the kids get to our level, I mean, they've been wired for so long. I mean, it's really hard to fundamentally change mechanics. You can tweak something here or there that maybe the nuanced eye could see, but you know, in general, if you're watching the guy's delivery from 4 years ago or today, you're probably not going to see a whole lot of change. So I would, you know, at the level we get the guys, they're pretty well ingrained. It's kind of a nuance.
It's probably a setup change here more than anything, right?
I think a lot of times you do that, you know, you'll change rubber position. You might change, you know, the width of a stance or something. You might change where they start their hands. You might change, you know, things. Yeah. I mean, right. What least invasive action gives us the biggest output? That's what we're all searching for. That's what we're all searching for. Yep.
Who helped Luke Weaver find his changeup?
Oh, man, I'll tell you what. You got to give a ton of credit. This is where the analytics and the coaches, you know, really combine forces well. And I think, I mean, I'm biased, but I think the Yankees do it probably better than anyone. But, you know, it's not my place to talk or say specifically any of those things. I can just only tell you that, you know, Matt Blake and Desi Druschel and Harkey and the folks in the analytics department with us in New York communicate really well, you know. So it's like Michael Fishman and David Grabner and his team are the best in the business. And that's, I think, and then you have Luke Weaver, right? Who's like, you watch Luke Weaver, he knows what he's doing. I mean, so sometimes it's like making a suggestion to a player that's got elite level aptitude and they can figure things out themselves in some way. So probably a multitude. Again, you know.
It's my favorite pitch in baseball right now.
Nasty. And he's got a damn good heat to go
with it. And I love the changeup anyway, but it's my favorite pitch to watch. Just when you see a ball do that, you just know how special that is and how hard it is to hit that pitch. It's just it's a piece
of art.
It's a piece of art. Like when a guy can make a ball do that, it's a piece of art. It's art.
Yeah, like Tommy Canley. Tommy Canley can tell these guys his changeup is coming and they still can't hit it. I mean, it's like, okay, you know, it's a pretty good changeup. Yeah, he's got a nasty one. Some of these guys too, like playing catch with a lot of these guys, it's fun. But I'll tell you, you know, I'm better at it now because I've seen so many of them over the years. But boy, some of these guys, it's scary to death catching their, you know, because it's a slider changeup and you haven't seen it before and you're catching a big league guy. You might, you know, the average person's going to whiff it. I mean, that's the action on some of these pitches. They just disappear at the bottom. Yeah.
Do you have to put gear on now?
Thankfully.
I never got to that point. I would catch guys. I'd catch their flat grounds. I'd catch their bullpens. And I was like, I refuse. I refuse to put gear on. If I get hit, I get hit. I'll jump out of the way if I need to. But I refused to put gear on.
I've gotten back there a few times, but I try to stay away from that. You know, I'm getting close to 50 or so. It's like, yeah.
Do you have a fail forward moment? Everybody's got to answer this one. So something you thought was going to sidetrack you, but looking back now, it helped you move forward.
Fail forward moment for me. You know, I guess it was probably the fact that I didn't end up being a very good player. You know, failed as a player and then forward luckily into the kind of the front office and or back office or whatever, and you know, have seen that evolve over time. You know, that's evolved for me over time. As far as like within the role, I mean, I made plenty of mistakes, geez, along the way. I think one thing early on in the rehab process, you know, I would get really giddy about guys throwing hard early, you know, and they look good and they tell me, oh man, I'm recovering well, I'm doing great. And it's like, and we had a one guy I can remember in particular that, you know, just like, didn't go well, you know. So I think the fail forward in that sense is like it's really opened my eyes to how to progress guys. You know, it's like, you know, you have to know in the rehab process when is the right time to push, and there's really no guide for it. I mean, we've had guys come back We had one guy recently who came back, and this is rare in this day and age, but he was in a game in 12 months and had no setbacks and didn't get hurt. We've also had guys who've taken 18 months, you know, or some guys that had, you know, even have a redo surgery. So you have like that fail forward moment told me that all these guys are unique, but be really careful when they start to go early in the process. We have all these like demarcation points in the rehab, and at those junctures, you really got to be cognizant of what their intensity levels are and how they're responding. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you that. It's still around 18 months, isn't it? You know, even though surgery's gotten better, the protocols have gotten better, it's still kind of around that 18 month period for
it depends. I mean, I feel pretty confident when most of our guys 14, 15 is where we'll be. Yep. And then we'll occasionally get one on a little bit in front of that, and we'll occasionally get one a little bit behind. But I would say with us, the average is 14 to 15. Yep.
Have your daily habits and routines developed over time? You and I mean, I'm already 50. You're pushing 50. Do you have any daily habits or routines you've developed over time you feel like help?
Yeah, diet. Diet, man. I mean, that's been the number one thing for me. And I probably wouldn't have ever changed if I didn't get the job in performance science. But when I had to think about hiring a nutritionist, talk to kids about the importance of eating, and I'm like, am I doing this? I'm not, right? So, and then you learn a lot, right? You just learn that, I mean, if you want to lose weight and maintain your weight, it's a simple formula. It's not just go eat organic food and you're going to be healthy, right? You still have to worry about your caloric intake, what are my expenditures, and you kind of get more into that. I'm very particular and regimented about what I eat. Yeah.
Are you in a window? Are you in a fasting window at all?
Used to. I've tried them all. I did kind of the gluten-free or whatever, that diet, and stayed away from a lot of carbs. I've done the intermittent fasting, where you're eat for 8 and you're off for 16. I think all of those, what it did for me was I just learned something. I learned through the, that I didn't need all the bread. You get the sub and but yeah, maybe just half's fine or every once in a while, but the sandwich tastes pretty good even if you don't have the bread. Don't eat all the french fries. And then with the fasting, you learn that you're capable of, it's actually good to feel a little bit hungry, right? It's like every time I feel hungry, I don't need to feed myself. And you learn, my body's going to respond to that. And then I've just evolved now into, I just, try to create one cheat night a week and just try to be really clean otherwise. Yeah.
I just gauge my energy level as soon as I wake up. Yeah. If my energy level is good as soon as I wake up, I'm staying with what I'm doing.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, you've always been in great shape though. I mean, so I feel like you've always been a guy that's been pretty good with that side of things. Well, you've always been a holistic guy anyway.
It takes a lot of work. It does. I don't take for granted my routine, and it does take a lot of discipline. But I think over time it's much easier because again, that's any habit you develop. I don't even really think about it anymore. With what I eat, I'm very boring the way I eat.
Yeah.
Now in my feeding window, I eat a lot. I do. Like if you came and watched me eat, like I eat a lot when I'm eating, but it's almost like I don't even have to think about it. I'm very boring when I go to the grocery store. It's the same stuff. Like it's.
So you're on the 8:16. You're doing the internet.
I don't like. It's not like hard and fast with that.
I got you.
But usually after 6:30 p.m. there's nothing nutrition wise going in because that's what I'm gauging off. I just know if I eat later, I'm going to be a little bit more sluggish when I wake up in the morning.
You get older
and that's
you
a
have
blood
kids.
Cleaning thing. When you look at the science of that, you're allowing your body to clean your blood. Anytime you eat something, all your blood and your body's is taking care of digestion. Like that's how it works.
Yeah.
So the longer you can go without that and not starving yourself either. Like I said, I'm not till one time a day in my feeding window. I eat a lot. So I think the goal for me is energy level, but also never feeling full and never feeling hungry throughout the day.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, most things are simple, right? I mean, at the end of the day, if you have a simple, framework or a way of deciding, that works. I mean, that's kind of the best case scenario.
And a lot
sleep
of fruits
too.
And vegetables.
Lots. Yeah. Tons. Lots of carrots, you know.
Carrots and avocados. So I was going to say mushrooms. I eat a lot of raw. A shout out to my mom because we always had raw vegetables and fruits in the house. So I just got used to eating them.
Well, they're great because they're fillers. You feel like you're eating a lot. You don't get a ton of calories with them. But the point too about, you know, you're saying your grocery shopping is really boring. That's been a great thing for us. Is like you don't have to. It's one less thing to think about. We got all this crap to think about, you know, the kids and the job and what are we hassles and everything else. And it's like, well, if I know what I'm going to do at the grocery, I don't have to think about planning a list. It's a win.
And that's a high performance thing too. When you look at whether it's, you know, Steve Jobs or Zuckerberg or whatever, they wear the same thing every day. They don't, because it's decision fatigue. So it eliminates decision fatigue when you don't really have to think about it. But those guys are special for a reason too.
So.
All right. What's some final thoughts before I let you go?
Geez, final thoughts. I never thought we'd be, you know, having this conversation, whatever, how many years later, Rhino? 30, almost 30 years later. I'm a little more gray than you. You don't look as, you've aged better than I have, but I'll tell you the final thoughts is, you know, great to catch up with you. All the things you're doing for the world of baseball and coaches and trying to educate those guys and make them better. I think it's awesome, you know, and you know, all the content you can get out there. We talked through a few things today. Maybe it sparks, you know, particularly in the younger guys, like just having an idea, you know, that's really important. Just having an idea. And you know, it's fortunate. I think the last thing I'll say is I think everybody that, you know, just how fortunate people should be for the situations they're in. And I say that as, you know, being very, you talk about the different experiences or whatever that I've had, and it's really been nothing that I've done, but I've been in a great organization and kind of got lucky, you know, to be honest with you. And there's no magic for that. So
that and be a good teammate. I tell people that all the time. I tell players that I speak at youth clinics. I'm like, that's one of my go-tos every time that they want me to talk is reminding kids to be good teammates.
Yeah.
Because you don't think about it at the time, but if you weren't a good teammate, there's no way you and I are talking right now. If I wasn't a good teammate to you, there's no way you and I are talking right now. There's no chance.
Well, and you know, here's the last point, right? Sometimes being a good teammate means getting in somebody's, you know what, right? And I remember in Northern Iowa when you came and you grabbed me in the dugout, and you know, I was probably jacking something up, right? Screwed up a PFP or something, whatever it was, right, that I did. And you got me, man. You know, I jumped back at you. But I think that's like – so – and that's the one great thing about Sam and the Yankees is I don't always agree with him, and we don't always agree in our room. But we know that everybody's got the same intent. We know that, you know, our love for the organization and what we're all trying to collectively do trumps any one of us. And that's the thing. So sometimes being a great teammate means support, and sometimes being a great teammate means like you're gonna call a guy out, or you're gonna tell him what you think.
Love somebody, you're gonna be honest with them. Like it doesn't 100%. Always feel good, but if you love somebody, you're gonna be honest with them. And I always felt like the position players and the pitchers needed to be that accountability for each other, because I think it's just harder. Like if a pitcher goes after a pitcher or a position player goes after a position player, I think it's easier because it's not the same positions. Like Kyle Ritter, people don't know who Kyle Ritter is, but he was my college roommate. He's a doctor now, but he was my guy at Evansville. Like when I needed it, when I needed somebody to get on me, it was Kyle because he was a pitcher. And I think that cross works better in a team setting.
Agreed.
Agreed. All right. Love you. Glad you're safe.
You too, Rhino.
Tell Julie I said what's up. We're trying to get a baseball soccer alum weekend going in April. So hopefully we all can get back.
That would be awesome. Yeah, we'd definitely make an appearance for that one.
Awesome. All right.
Tell everybody how. Tell Tim, JV, I said hey, too. Okay. All right, Rhino.
I was excited to finally be able to get John on the podcast. He's one of the smartest baseball people I've been around and was a great college teammate. Congrats to the Yankees on their success this season. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, Matt West, and Antonio Walker in the ABC office for all the help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, @coachb_ABCA, or direct message me via the MyBC app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you.
Wait for another day.